This is The Guardian.
This holiday season, we've been revisiting some of our favourite episodes from 2021, and today we're replaying an episode from Guardian Australia's brilliant daily podcast, Full Story. It's a tale of how nine experienced hikers were mysteriously killed in Russia's Ural Mountains. Conspiracy theories circled for years, but an unlikely pairing of science and the movie Frozen may have helped solve the cold case.
I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story.
So the mystery is known as the Dyatlov Pass. It began in the winter of 1959 in the Soviet Union near the Ural Mountains, which is incredibly cold. It's the sort of place that you'd only want to go to if you really wanted to, like, test your limits.
Robin Andrews is a volcanologist and a freelance journalist.
10 people from a nearby university wanted to somehow spend 2 weeks, 16 days skiing and hiking for 200 miles across this mountain range. There were 8 men and 2 women, and they're all very experienced mountaineers.
So how did this trip go?
I mean, it went terribly. It went as terribly as any trip could go.
So I've come up to the pluck. It's covered in snow. Take some of the snow off. There's a portrait of a young man. It's a very Soviet-looking design, the young man in profile. He's looking forward into a bright future. And then higher up it says, in this mountain pass, on a freezing night on the 2nd of February, some tourists from the Urals Polytechnic Institute died.
The story of this trip and what happened on that mountain in 1959 is Russia's biggest unsolved mystery. It spawned conspiracy theories ranging from aliens, yetis, and secretive government operations, and has enthralled the global online community for years. But earlier this year, a team of scientists published an article detailing a surprising research process that may have solved this mystery. Today, has the mystery of the Dyatlov Pass been solved? So, Robin, the students are on the mountain. What happens?
As they were making the journey, one of the students, he had to turn back because he had basically sciatica, joint pain, so he decided a few days in that he would turn back, and he assumed that he would see all his friends again and they would be fine, and he didn't. From the diaries left by the students, know that the conditions were, you know, it's incredibly windy, even for this place. It was incredibly cold. And sometime around the night of February 1st, they pitched a tent on these sort of snowy slopes of a mountain that whose name in the language of the indigenous Mansi people means dead mountain, which is incredibly ominous.
Wow.
And they cut into a slope that was a very low angle slope, you know, just this sort of protection from the wind, because the wind was incredibly strong. And after that, they were never heard from again.
So what happens next?
A month later, a search team got there and they found the tent just sticking up out of the snow. Rather bizarrely, it looked like it'd been cut open from the inside. So the implication here was someone inside was in a rush to get outside, which in those harsh winter conditions in the middle of the night is a very strange thing to do. The following day, two bodies were found just over a mile away from where the tent was. It looked like they were scattered around a makeshift campfire, which would have been really ineffective in the middle of the night in Russian winter. They basically were wearing almost no clothes. I think they had some underwear on. And there were damages to the branches of a tree, a pine tree, a few metres high. And it suggested for some reason that one of these guys tried to climb the tree. It wasn't really clear why that was. Maybe to get some wood or something hanging off the tree. But it was odd that anyone would want to climb a tree in the middle of the night. And then over the next few months, as the snow thawed, the rest of the students were found, some nearer the camp and some further away, but they were found in a horrific state.
What do you mean?
Some of them were found with weird bruises that looked like they were beaten. Some of them had eyes missing. One lacked a tongue. Some of the skulls and rib cages had been violently smashed open. It looked like there had been some sort of violent ambush or attack. Even stranger, there were elevated levels of radioactivity on a couple of the victims' clothing. It was immediately seen by the search team as quite frightening and inexplicable.
Mm.
It must have been a terrifying thing to come across.
So this group of university students are found in, you know, very distressing state and in a bizarre scene, really. Was there any sort of investigation? Did people start looking into this?
There was a criminal investigation, but it was quickly wrapped up. They concluded that it was some insurmountable natural force, some spontaneous power of nature of some sort. And that is vague enough that in any country that would cause some suspicion.
Mm.
But this also happened in the Soviet Union, a notoriously opaque government, and no one really believed anything that they said.
Mm.
They kind of wrapped it under the rug. They just ruled out foul play. They deemed that some people died from their injuries, and almost casually they slipped in that maybe an avalanche sort of somehow triggered a series of events which led to their deaths.
I imagine that would have been really unsatisfying for family and friends who've just lost, you know, someone they love.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been, you know, it would have been painful in any sense, but the fact that there was so much ambiguity and they didn't have any concrete answers must have been incredibly hurtful. And it probably didn't help that around the time the Soviet Union collapsed, a retired government official came out and said, oh, well, I mean, there were bright lights seen in the area at the time, say some people, so maybe it was aliens.
What?
It sort of breathed new life into the more outlandish theories that this grim fate that might have befallen these unfortunate 9 students.
It all sounds quite spooky to someone who doesn't know much about hiking. What could possibly explain this rather bizarre-looking behaviour?
Something spooked them. Something panicked them. That's why they all went charging out of the tent. Something like an attack. Something like a yeti. Something living on the mountain could have potentially attacked them.
You mentioned that there were outlandish theories growing in the public imagination around this story. Can you talk me through that? I mean, how did the public myth of this grow over the years?
So let's start with the slightly less strange conspiracy theories. That, you know, the one that kept coming up a lot was, oh, it was the Cold War. One of these guys was studying nuclear physics, so maybe he knew something that they didn't want anyone to know. So for some reason, you know, the solution to that was make it look like the abominable snowman had attacked them, which actually then became its own theory that, oh, yes, yetis must have attacked them. No one had explored these wilderness so much. So what else would have caused such violent, horrible injuries and could have disappeared into the woods, you know? That was, yeti is a popular one. I think the one that people kept gravitating towards as maybe likely was it was some military test that went wrong, especially because of that weird note about two of them being weirdly irradiated. And but again, you know, why would the Soviet Union make it look so horrific? As someone horribly said to me, in a way, there are easier ways to get rid of 9 nosy students than to leave them in pieces all over a mountain.
How would you, in terms of conspiracy theories that we hear around the world, I mean, is this quite popular? Is it quite well known? How would you rate it?
It's actually enormously popular. You know, it's not one of those things that's kind of niche, especially after the Cold War ended and it became, in Russia, it's a national obsession.
Mm.
And in other parts of the world, it's just this thing that's people are absolutely obsessed with because it's so puzzling.
Okay, so it became this worldwide and very popular conspiracy theory. Why are we talking about it now?
В прямом эфире Генеральная прокуратура Российской Федерации. Меня зовут Александр Куренной, я официальный представитель ведомства. Здравствуйте.
So, over the last few years, the Russian government has attempted to reopen the investigation just because of the deluge of conspiracy theories.
Mm.
In 2019, they made it a very public inquiry into it. What became known as the Dyatlov Pass incident, Dyatlov being the surname of Igor Dyatlov, who led the expedition. They just had a quick look at it, and in 2020 they said, yep, it was an avalanche, and they gave no details as to how this was possible. It kind of set it into overdrive. Even scientists were brought into it just by journalists asking questions, because it was the renewed interest by this terrible rubbish investigation just kind of exploded. So I think it had the opposite effect to what they were going for.
So this 2019 investigation concluded once again that it was an avalanche, but people weren't really buying it, it sounds like. What were some of the key issues that they had with the avalanche explanation?
So, I mean, the first basic thing was like, well, everyone knows avalanches have to happen on a slope of 30 degrees. And a good way to visualize that is if you put two books on top of each other, the top book is not just going to spontaneously slide off the top one. You have to tilt it to a certain degree. When it gets to a certain point, which for snow seems to be 30 degrees, an avalanche is way more likely to happen. And they said, well, the slope was way too shallow. No way you get an avalanche. It doesn't matter if they cut into it or not. And they were experienced, so they would have known that it would have been fine to cut into. No way would you get an avalanche. So that's one of the key points. From their diaries, we know that there was no snowfall on that night. And to get an avalanche, you don't just need some snow on a slope. You need to load up the snow. The injuries, again, were horrible. I mean, yes, some people in avalanches have died through like physical injuries, but it's overwhelmingly likely that they would have died through asphyxiation or hypothermia without these just violent injuries to them. But perhaps one of the weirdest things of all is that is even if they said, okay, say there was an avalanche and an avalanche had occurred, we know again from forensic evidence and diary entries, they made this cut in the slope to put their tent. So why was there at least 9 hours? You know, it could have been way longer, but at least 9 hours between them cutting the slope and an avalanche occurring. Because surely, you cut the slope, if it's unstable, it would collapse on top of you straight away. So what magical force was stopping this avalanche actually happening?
Okay, so no snow, not enough slope, lots of fundamental issues with this explanation. What happened from there?
So this is where like an unlikely duo of scientists kind of came into the picture.
And now we're getting there.
And the first was Alexander Puzrin. He's a geotechnical engineer. He is really interested in landslides. He's at ETH Zurich in Switzerland.
It is really a great honor for me to be here today. I'm going to talk today about the growth of slip surfaces and how it affected my life.
In 2019, he happened to write a paper explaining that when you have an earthquake, you can get an avalanche and a landslide. But sometimes there's a gap of minutes or hours because not all rocks are alike. And sometimes you can shake something loose, but internally it's still just strong enough to hold up for a while before it collapses.
So this slow growth continues until you cannot maintain equilibrium anymore and slip surface starts propagating catastrophically, leading to the avalanche release.
And one of the people who reviewed that paper was Johan Gohm.
Hello, everyone. My name is Johan Gohm, and I am professor at École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, EPFL, in Switzerland.
He's the head of the Snow Avalanche Simulation Laboratory, which, by the way, sounds amazing.
So here you see on top the processes required for the release and flow of an avalanche. So everything
and
starts.
And he was contacted by a reporter, I think from the New York Times in 2019, when the Russian government reopened the investigation, say like, hey, you know about snow, what do you think about this?
Some journalists wanted to get my expert opinion about what happened that night and especially about the plausibility of a slab avalanche.
And they explained the story to him and they mentioned the delay, that weird 9 hour delay. He's like, I've reviewed a paper where almost this exact thing has kind of played out.
I decided to go deeper from a scientific point of view and I teamed up with Alexander Puzrin from ETH Zurich to do some research.
So essentially they met at a conference and they started talking about it and they just out of curiosity they thought, yeah, let's have a crack at it. Let's see if we can solve the coldest of cold cases.
So
So basically, you know, an avalanche expert and a snow expert team up and decide to start looking into one of the biggest mysteries out of Russia and on the internet. How did they start?
Yeah, some things are quite intuitive. So Johan was telling me, like, he doesn't just study snow, he, like, loves snow. He absolutely loves it. Mm. And he says that he just from experience knows that the idea that you could only get an avalanche on a 30-degree slope is just crap. Yeah, that's, like, the textbook thing. But it depends on, like, what the snow is like, and not all snowfall is the same. And so he said, yeah, you don't need 30 degrees. I mean, you need some slope. But even the reports at the time noted that the slope was shallower than that. It looked like it was 23 degrees, I think. But it wasn't actually that shallow. It was an illusion created by snow falling over like an undulating landscape. So it made the snow kind of filled in those gaps. So even to these experienced students, the slope would have looked a lot shallower than it actually was. It also depends on what the snow is made of. If there's an underlying layer to the snow that's really not very good at sticking together. You know, sometimes if you're in a snowball fight and you pick up a bit of snow and the snow just doesn't bunch into a ball, it just collapses into these, like, into this just useless clump of ice. That was essentially the stuff that was under, like, the proper snow on top. And if you have that under, like, a big thick bit of snow, the snow on top will easily slide off. It acts like a sort of conveyor belt for the snow on top. So even on a shallower slope, you can still have an avalanche if you have this kind of weak snow layer underneath. And reports from the original investigation actually noted that that was the case.
So they debunked some of these key issues that people had with the avalanche theory. What did they do from there?
Okay, so something else that they thought was quite important is that in the diaries it said it was really windy, and they looked at the weather reports from the time, and yeah, there was no snow, but if it's very cold and you have winds blowing over a mountain, you can get something called katabatic winds. And essentially they're just really cold clumps of air. This cold air will rush down, they'll stampede down the mountain, and it will bring anything along with it, like snow, anything like that. So it's thought very likely that these really strong winds were katabatic winds, but a computer model designed by Alex, he threw a lot of maths there, and he worked out that, yeah, very easily, these winds in just a few hours could have brought a lot of snow right atop the slope that the tent was cut into. So already they found an avalanche was perfectly possible.
So they figure out that the slope, the wind and the snow could all add up. Does this solve all of the questions that people have about the Dyatlov Pass?
It does not, because then people say, okay, well, sure, you can have an avalanche, but an avalanche would never cause these kind of injuries. These injuries are absolutely horrific. How would you lose a tongue? How would you get your skull crushed?
So how do a snow and an earthquake expert set about answering these things?
This is probably the point in which the story gets stranger. Where, and in fact, it's strange in the sense that the solution to this part of the mystery is stranger than the mystery.
What do you mean?
So in this case, unbelievably, the way they actually worked out that snow could cause such horrific injuries...
Elsa?
...was thanks to the 2013 Disney movie Frozen.
Do you want to build a snowman?
Which, I don't know if you've seen it, doesn't contain any gore or blood or violence. It just doesn't really contain that.
No, I don't think of Frozen and gruesome deaths in the same sentence, really.
Yeah, it's all about wanting to build a snowman, not wanting to murder 9 students in the woods in Soviet Russia. It's just not...
Do you want to build a snowman? It doesn't have to be a snowman.
Hang on, I...
Okay, bye.
Next. How a Disney movie may have helped solve the mystery of the Dyatlov Pass. So, Robin, what is the link between this mystery and the movie Frozen?
So, Johan, chief of the Snow Avalanche Laboratory, he was watching this movie and he's like, oh, damn, they're really... The snow movement in this movie is really realistic.
Throughout the history of Disney animation, we have seen time and time again films that have magical and fanciful worlds in which our timeless characters live. Creating compelling and magical-looking effects for these worlds directly enhances the storytelling and draws our audience into the action. Effects such as wind, fire, rain, and snow.
Like, they've really nailed it. It's not, like, cartoonishly weird. It looks like real snow.
Mm. It's very difficult to simulate avalanches because snow is a very complex material and its mechanical behavior is not fully understood yet. It's very difficult to find a unified and large-strain framework to simulate the whole avalanche process.
With a film such as Frozen, the story would have been impossible to tell without compelling and believable-looking snow. But how do you animate all that snow?
Credit to him, he actually emailed Disney, how did you animate that? How did you make it look so realistic? So they naturally invited him to Hollywood, and he met with the specialist who worked on Frozen snow effects and actually helped explain the science behind it and the maths and the physics to actually get it to look realistic. It turns out it was the most realistic snow simulation that existed.
Wow.
It's through the power of simulation that our artists can art direct real-world physics into a Disney-style wonderland. All thanks to simulation.
So Johan thought, you know what? I'm going to use this as a basis of a model to simulate how people can die in avalanches, which again is a dark turn for it to make.
Okay, so he's managed to take this method of simulation that Frozen uses. How is it helpful to him? What does he do with it?
It turns out just because this code that he tweaked to make his own model could simulate the impact of falling snow so well, so realistically, that they thought, well, if we apply that to human bodies, we could see how injured they get. Mm. And that's where, again, it gets weirder.
Beginning with 1974 models, the law requires that all automobiles sold in this country be equipped with a passenger restraint system conforming to certain specifications.
Because very casually, Alex, you know, the avalanche landslide guy, just said, oh, well, we did some searching, and it turns out in 1970s, General Motors wanted to kind of calibrate the seatbelts.
Just settle into your 1974 GM car. Now buckle your lap belt and the shoulder harness.
So instead of using crash test dummies, they just wrote to the mayor of, I think, Detroit and said, can we have 100 dead bodies?
Ooh.
Like, recently dead bodies. And so what are you going to do with these dead bodies? Like, well, we are going to fire bricks and concrete slabs at them at 100 miles an hour to kind of simulate car crashes just so we know what kind of seatbelt will save people's lives.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not kid-friendly, is it?
You get in, sit down, and buckle up. Everything is right. Go ahead. Start your engine.
Alex was saying, they broke their ribs. They hit them with different weights at different velocities. But as it turns out, these cadavers were kind of sometimes just sort of like freestanding in a way, or they were leaning against a rigid support, like a chair. You know, most people drive a car sitting in a chair.
Mm.
So this is completely coincidental, but at the time the students near Dead Mountain died, they would have been asleep, so they would have been lying on their backs. And not only that, but they would have built the foundations for their bedding from their skis, I think their wooden skis. So actually, unusually for people caught in an avalanche, they weren't just tumbling about in the snow. They actually were sleeping backwards on a very rigid surface, which completely changes the dynamics of what an avalanche would do to a person. So they, with all this information, they came up with this really grim but incredibly precise model that would actually say, well, if you get hit by a block of ice in this very specific situation, it will impact you with this much force and it will give you these sort of injuries. The avalanche actually would have only needed to be rather small, not the sort of thing you see in movies where the whole mountain roars and a whole bunch of snow crashes into a village. You'd actually only need a rather solid, icy block, maybe 16 feet long, to kind of slide into this tent and actually cause these injuries. So only by complete fluke did all this come together.
Okay, let me try a summary of all of this. So the katabatic winds could have brought the snow over the mountain, triggering a small avalanche on this slope that, due to the data that we've got from Frozen and the seatbelt safety experiment, we know could have caused most of the injuries that were found on these students. Is this mystery solved with all of that?
Well, it's certainly the best explanation we've got yet, because it's one that's founded in, you know, science and reason and something you can kind of test. The avalanche itself kind of seems, if not like 100%, it's a pretty plausible thing to happen. But then everything that happened after that is speculation, because the avalanche didn't kill these students immediately. You know, they cut themselves out of the tent. They probably fled in a sort of panic out of the tent and into the forest, you know, downslope. The ones that had really, really severe injuries probably couldn't walk themselves.
Mm.
And that's kind of one of the things about the story, is a lot of it kind of comes across as like a story of terror and horror. And it kind of, in a way, it obviously is. But the fact that no one was left in the tent suggests that their friends brought their injured friends out of the tent to try and at least give them a chance of surviving. I mean, it's almost no way they were going to, but it makes this one of a story of kind of courage as well as kind of horror sort of thing.
What about some of those more eerie and unexplainable things, like the radiation, the missing tongue and various other body parts?
Yeah, so there are a lot of little details that are like hard to explain, which probably is what the proponents of the more outlandish theories will jump on.
Mm.
There is an idea that the lamps they had, the sort of lanterns, had a bit of thorium in, which is radioactive, and that might explain, you know, the slightly elevated radioactivity on a couple of the bodies. Also, one of the students was a nuclear physicist, so it's nothing kind of too unusual. It's not like they were glowing in the dark or anything.
Mm.
The missing eyes and tongue are really gruesome and weird, except that often if bodies are left out in the wilderness, wild animals scavenging at things to eat will probably eat the softest tissue first, so that includes things like eyes and the tongue. So that's really grim, but that's a completely plausible explanation. You know, you don't need to invoke something supernatural.
Mm.
And even the authors of this study, they explicitly say we're not claiming to have solved everything. We're just trying to offer a reasonable account of events that triggered the deaths.
Mm, I suppose it does strike me that a lot of time and energy has been put into solving this mystery. I mean, who has gained from this at the end? Has this actually helped people?
It's hard to tell at the moment just because it's just come out, essentially. But the idea, you know, one of the hopes behind this study is by offering a plausible explanation that's nothing malicious or supernatural or anything, something that's grounded in science, the family members of the victims some comfort in the sense that no violent, angry, intentional force killed them. It was a freak force of nature in a way. And it was also one that, you know, was so unusual in, it would have only happened at that spot at that time of night, you know, that even the most experienced mountaineers would not have seen this coming.
Mm.
So the kind of general hope of the researchers is it will help redeem the legacy of some of the hikers, because apparently some of the voices in Russia suggest that what they did was completely reckless and silly, and, you know, whatever killed them, of course something killed them, they went out into the wilderness. So the idea is that this will help stifle that kind of that unfounded criticism.
Robin, I'm struck by the fact that this story is actually a feat of modern science and technology. We had to wait until this moment in movie animation and science to have all the tools at hand to answer this mystery, right?
Right. This mystery could have only been solved at this exact moment in time, which in itself is kind of ridiculous. But what is even stranger to me is that the story of Frozen is kind of inspired by an old Hans Christian Andersen story called The Snow Queen, which came out 150 years ago.
Mm.
Imagine going back in time and saying, so this beautiful story about snow queens and things that you're writing will one day solve the weirdest murder mystery on the planet. So well, I'd love to go back in time and just tell him this and just watch his mind explode.
I'm Hans Christian Andersen. I've many a tale to tell. And though I'm a cobbler, I'd say I tell them rather well. I'll mend your shoes and I'll fix your boots when I have a moment free. When I'm not otherwise occupied as a purple duck or a mountainside or a quarter after three. I'm Hans Christian Andersen.
In the memory of those who have gone and will never return, we have named this mountain pass in their honor, the Dyatlov Pass. Igor Dyatlov, the leader of the group, Zina Kolmogorova, Yuri Doroshenko, Rustam Slabodin, Yuri Krivonishenko, Alexander Kolevatov, Ludmila Dubinina, Nikolai Tibobrignol, Semyon Zolotaryov, he was the oldest one in the group. He was 38 years old when he died.
Thanks to Robin Andrews for his time. Do check out his National Geographic article on this. We've linked it on the Full Story page. He's also done a comprehensive Twitter thread as well. You can find him on the handle at @SquigglyVolcano. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Joe Koning. Our executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to subscribe, plus leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.
We'll all be back from tomorrow with all new episodes of Today in Focus.
This is The Guardian.